It's all about the oil.
Delta goes where no airline has gone before.
From APM, American Public Media, I'm Jeremy Hobson in Los Angeles.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Tuesday, the 1st of May.
Coming up, a conversation with the Secretary of the Interior, Ken Salazar.
Also, what do we really know about America's largest company?
And there's a term in business, cash cushion. Well, Ford is taking it literally.
These stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Delta Airlines has had enough of high fuel prices, so it's buying its own refinery, as Marketplace's Heidi Moore reports.
Delta Airlines is the first airline to buy an oil refinery.
It's certainly out-of-the-box thinking.
Richard Abulafia is an analyst with Teal Group. One of the biggest costs to airlines is jet fuel. The airlines usually speculate on gas prices with the help of Wall Street to protect themselves against big price changes. But that's a risky strategy, and they could lose money as easily as they make it. Besides, airlines have to pay a lot more for refined jet fuel than the crude oil burbling under the ground. This deal makes it cheaper.
Having some control of the refined product gives you some degree of stability on prices, which is certainly welcome given this volatile fuel environment.
But even if Delta's oil refinery deal works out well, fares are probably not going to drop.
I don't think there's going to be any trickle-down impact to consumers. Not enough to show up in ticket prices. They're going to charge whatever the market can bear.
As usual, airlines will keep those cost savings to themselves. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Chesapeake Energy reports profits today. Chesapeake has just disclosed that the Internal Revenue Service wants to know more about perks for its CEO. The IRS is interested in questionable loans taken out by the company's leader. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Chesapeake Energy bets big on fracking, that controversial way to coax oil and gas out of rock. The issue now, though, is the fracking balance sheet. Investors just learned that CEO Aubrey McClendon used his personal stake in company wells as collateral to borrow $1 billion to invest in more wells. Accounting professor Edward Ketz at Penn State says McClendon could be serving two masters.
The CEO of Chesapeake Energy would find himself owing allegiance to the firm and to the lender of this fund.
And he wonders why McClendon borrowed from a board member who helped decide his salary. Chesapeake debt has been downgraded. At least seven law firms have initiated class action lawsuits and other inquiries, and the feds are sniffing. Analyst Michael Briard at Hodges Capital Management says McClendon attracts scrutiny.
Well, you listen to his conference calls, he does have a very high opinion of himself. This company, now it's the second largest gas producer in the U.S. and one of the top 10 oil producers.
In the oil business, he says, if you've done it, it ain't bragging. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Today, a government-private partnership known as Brand USA will start spending about $12 million to entice British, Canadian, and Japanese tourists to visit. The U.S. Department of the Interior, along with Commerce and Homeland Security, are also working on ways to make it easier for tourists from farther-off places like Brazil and China to get visas. Interior Secretary Ken Salazar is the man with some tourist-attracting pieces of real estate in his portfolio, including the Grand Canyon. He also has some underground fossil fuel that's of interest to more than just tourists. Secretary Salazar, good morning.
Good morning, David. How are you?
Doing very well. Thank you. Give me a sense of what you're trying to do with Homeland Security on making it, what, a little easier for people from other countries to pay us a visit?
We believe that we can create another 2 to 3 million jobs here in the United States through our efforts on tourism and bringing people who have money, who want to spend it here in places that have to be discovered by the rest of the world. We have a wonderful country, and I'm proud to be the secretary that's a custodian over much of it.
Your department also has a little troika going now. It's a new thing with the Department of Energy and the Environmental Protection Agency. The headline is about unconventional research into sources of natural gas and oil. I mean, that's got to be hydraulic fracturing and things like that, fracking.
Yes, we have a very abundant natural gas supply in the country. So it's a good way to get us to greater energy independence and also to do it in an environmentally sound way. But also, as I've said to industry and others around the country, if we don't do certain things with hydraulic fracturing, that there's an Achilles heel there, because if people don't know what's being injected, for example, into the underground, they're going to rebel against it. So, you know, we believe that there ought to be disclosure of what companies are using for hydraulic fracturing.
How does it work? I remember, I think it was the energy law that passed back in 2006 exempted some of this fracking from federal oversight.
What's really happened over the last 5 years is technologies have significantly increased our projections on the amount of natural gas that's available in places like in the Bakken Formation, which is mostly North Dakota. A little bit of it goes over into Montana, but there's a huge amount of oil. In fact, there are some people who are saying it's as much oil as Saudi Arabia, and we believe that it can be a source for United States energy. But we know also that it can be done in a manner that is safe and responsible. And so the rules that we'll put in place will be common sense kinds of rules.
Well, Ken Salazar, U.S. Secretary of the Interior, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, David. Have a great day.
The largest company in the U.S. by revenue brought in almost $500 billion last year. That's more than the gross domestic product of Norway. This company spends more money lobbying lawmakers in Washington than any other company. I'm talking about the oil giant ExxonMobil, a notoriously secretive company that few outsiders know much about. Well, today, Pulitzer Prize-winning author Steve Kahl is trying to shed some light. His book is out this morning. It's called Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. And for today's Midday Extra, he joins us for an extended interview. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I want to start with a quote in your book from the former CEO of Exxon, Lee Raymond, who said, quote, "I'm not a U.S. company and I don't make decisions based on what's good for the U.S." What did he mean by that?
Well, he's headquartered in the United States, but most of his employees live elsewhere, work elsewhere, and quite a lot of the profits that ExxonMobil makes are generated overseas and are difficult to repatriate. So they really see themselves as a global entity, sovereign and organized on behalf of their shareholders without reference to the government of the country where they happen to be headquartered.
But do they see themselves as representing American values overseas?
They do, yes. American, the rule of law, American business practices, best practices. Yes, I think in that respect they do, but not equating themselves with the interests of the United States government in the countries where they work.
Now, as you write, Exxon operates as if it were its own country. Give us a sense of the size of this thing and just how stretched out around the world it is.
Well, just think of the revenue is about $450 billion a year. That's about the GDP of Norway. It's about 3% of American GDP, roughly. And that revenue is associated with a pretty lean workforce, about 80,000 folks, and then a lot of the rest is contracted out. But they're spread all over the world. I think they say they operate in more than 150 countries, to be safe about it. And in many of those places, they're just in retail business or manufacturing chemicals. But in a substantial chunk of the world, they are drilling holes in the ground and sitting on top of them for 40 years at a time, which really involves them in the politics of Africa and Asia and Russia and Venezuela and lots of other places.
And in many cases, they have to deal with some pretty bad governments.
Well, this is the thing that I didn't quite understand as I started the research. If you're ExxonMobil and you look at the world and you want to own oil, it's important to understand their business model is they want to own oil and gas. They don't just want to contract to produce it. Then there's a limited number of places where you can acquire oil anymore. They've been thrown out of the Middle East by and large on resource nationalism grounds in that region. They can own oil and gas in the free market West because everybody can own property there. But otherwise, they kind of have to go to weak states that don't have the capacity to build their own national oil companies. So they end up disproportionately in places like Africa, which means they're on the ground in some really troubled places.
Do they have a motive beyond profit when they do something like that? Do they care if they're dealing with a really bad government?
I think they struggle to figure out what their corporate citizenship should be. And, you know, the European companies try to embarrass them by being greener and more forward-looking in the way they define their corporate citizenship in places like Africa. ExxonMobil's always been very conservative. We're not the Red Cross. We don't build roads. We don't build hospitals. Mm. We're here to pump oil, create jobs, provide profits to your government. We can't tell you what kind of government to run. And they've always been very sort of direct and unabashed about that. I think, though, the world is changing in this information age. Campaigners and citizens all over the world, even in really poor countries, have access to a lot more information. They have shared expectations about what big companies in their country should do. And, you know, the final point is in a lot of these African countries, for example, ExxonMobil is just disproportionately huge and powerful in the life of the country. A place like Chad, they were writing royalty and tax checks to the Chadian authoritarian government of nearly $1 billion a year. Well, the entire U.S. aid budget was, you know, less than $10 million. So if you're the dictator of Chad, who are you going to listen to? So I think in those settings, they haven't quite figured out how to be sustainable corporate citizens.
Let's talk about climate change. ExxonMobil, as you write, fought hard against the science of climate change under Lee Raymond, even hiring its own scientists when it didn't really like what other scientists were concluding.
Yeah, and they funded a lot of the most aggressive groups that were engaged in communication campaigns to challenge what was the emerging science at the UN and elsewhere in those years, right through the first Bush term and up till about 2006. Then Lee Raymond retired, and he was a chemical engineer of some accomplishment, really saw himself as a qualified scientist. So he said what he thought about the science and never wavered. His successor has said that he felt like ExxonMobil had a problem when he came in about its communication and its attitude towards public policy matters of this type, and that he set out to at least review it without radically changing it. And he did change their position about climate gradually over the next 3 or 4 years.
Well, you say review without radically changing. Where do they stand now?
Well, they now, first of all, they advocate a price on carbon-based fuels, which is unprecedented in their history. Here's an oil company saying, yeah, we should tax ourselves in order to incent a movement away from oil, gas, and coal. They are less certain about what the science actually shows, but they basically say, look, we recognize the risks are serious and the science is suggesting that they remain serious. So those are changes. I think they were in a position after the Lee Raymond era where they wanted to change their communication plan and some of their public policy positions, but they didn't want to admit that they'd ever done anything wrong in the past. Partly they feared that they might be sued the way the tobacco companies were. So they basically said, we were never wrong. We were misunderstood, but now we're changing our position.
How much of an impact did ExxonMobil have on U.S. climate policy? Because obviously they are a voice that are heard very loudly in the corridors of power in Washington.
You know, I think between 1997 and 2006, they really were significant. They played a unique role in the way they funded and led the American Petroleum Institute, the industry lobbying group, to take a very aggressive stance, challenging not just the Kyoto Accords, which were controversial and didn't have much political support, but the underlying science. That was the really aggressive tack that they took that a lot of other multinational corporations that didn't like Kyoto did not act that way. They argued against Kyoto on economic grounds, on fairness grounds, but they didn't challenge the science. And ExxonMobil really, for such a large corporation with such diverse shareholders, they really took a pretty aggressive stance in those years.
Are they heard in the same way under President Obama as they were in the Bush administration?
They're not. And they say that, you know, the Clinton administration was not a bad time for them by their account. I've heard ExxonMobil executives told me that they had as much access to the Clinton White House as they had to the Bush White House. Hmm. And because they didn't really see themselves as an instrument or an extension of the White House's foreign policy anyway, all they really wanted was to be able to talk about their issues when they came up. But the Obama administration, I think, has been a different kettle of fish for them. When the Democrats made a comeback after 2006, I don't think ExxonMobil was especially well prepared for that. And when they tried to adjust to the Democratic wave, they were really connected to the Hillary Clinton campaign, not the Obama administration. And so when the administration came in, they were really pretty well locked out.
When we hear leaders talk about oil today, especially with the rising prices and the fluctuations because of things that happen overseas, it's a very attractive idea to be independent of foreign oil. But it's an idea that it seems ExxonMobil does not think is a reality. What do they see as the vision for the future?
Well, they say about oil that it's a global liquid market and that pricing and supply is so integrated because it's so easy to transport oil that it's silly to talk about building walls and having – a completely independent supply. What you want is an efficient supply that's price efficient. Now, the argument against that is that if you did have a domestic surplus of oil production like Norway does, like the UK has had, then it affects your trade balance, it helps your economy. But it's not quite the same thing as being free from the world of oil, because you're still going to be a price taker. That is, if a war erupts in the Middle East and global oil prices go up, you're going to suffer just as if you were importing. So that's basically their vision of the global oil market. And I think it's shared by a lot of sort of well-informed market participants and governments. It's not so easy to translate at the pump, where, you know, middle class and working class drivers arrive at a gas station one day and find they're paying 15% more than they were the week before, and they wonder, why did that happen? Because it doesn't really seem clear how all of these sort of sources of volatility in the market arrive at the actual gas pump.
It's kind of amazing at the beginning of your book to read about the Exxon Valdez spill, which of course nowadays has been eclipsed by the bigger BP oil spill. Do you think that these things are just inevitable, or should lessons have been learned from the Valdez that weren't, and now we have more bigger ones?
Well, the National Bipartisan Commission that investigated the BP spill basically said not enough lessons had been learned. And I think what the underlying landscape is that deep water drilling and transport in harsh climates like Alaska, this is really frontier stuff. It's like the early days of aviation. They're out there doing things that they don't have a lot of experience in. There's a lot of volatility and stuff happens. And when it happens, the scale of catastrophic failure, as with a plane crash in the 1930s when planes went down all the time, it's startling. And it'll take a long time before the sort of idiot-proof systems and safety systems take hold in these really frontier environments of oil drilling.
But it does harm these companies a lot when it happens.
And they know that they're basically their reputation is one spill away. So they concentrate very heavily on trying to prevent these kind of bet-the-company vulnerabilities from materializing. And you can see in the BP case, I mean, you really are betting the company every time you go out and drill in these environments, because not just the $20 billion settlement price, but the fact that you're vulnerable to takeover and that your reputation takes a generation to recover. Exxon lived that. They survived it. But they're sort of obsessive about not letting it happen again. The question is whether any company with human beings in the workforce and the risks that they take in these environments can truly get to zero accidents. That's kind of the game they're playing. They are confident that they can do it, but the law of averages, you know, runs the other way.
Finally, Exxon is in a battle right now with Apple to be the biggest company in the U.S. by market capitalization. Reading this book about the leadership at Exxon and reading the Steve Jobs biography, you see two totally different management styles. How do you make sense of that?
I mean, I had the same reaction. I read the Jobs biography, which is quite wonderful. And you just think, what kind of a country produces as its number one and two largest corporations, Apple on the one hand and ExxonMobil on the other hand? And they're different businesses, of course, but the leadership styles really couldn't be more different. And they do reflect two sides of the American system. One very disciplined engineering and kind of management focused, that's Exxon, and the other very innovation focused and creative and California, which is what Apple's story is about.
But they're two very ruthless leaders in a way.
Yeah, and they have in common an emphasis on closed systems. I mean, one of the striking things about Apple and the Steve Jobs leadership style is that he did not brook open windows or a lot of outside compromises and partnerships. He did it his way, and that he very much had in common with ExxonMobil.
Steve Call is the author of Private Empire, ExxonMobil, and American Power. Steve Call, thanks so much.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
Stock markets are closed in China, South Korea, and across much of Europe for the 1st of May. It's International Workers' Day, organized by unions and left-leaning political parties across the world. Thousands of protesters are out on the streets in places like Greece, France, and Russia. From Paris, the BBC's Hugh Schofield reports that the protests are not just about unions this year.
Trade unions and socialist parties oppose the government cuts and austerity plans that European officials say are needed to get through the debt crisis. In Greece and also in Spain, protesters are calling for more state spending to boost growth and bring down unemployment. Haris Manoulis is out on the streets in Greece today. He's a striking steel worker.
Right now, May Day is a symbol for us. It's on our 183rd strike. One of the main reasons we are striking is that we can't turn our back on a struggle that's been won with blood.
Greece has elections on Sunday, as does France, where there are, in fact, three separate rallies in Paris. In France, I'm the BBC's Hugh Schofield for Marketplace.
Word this morning from Tokyo that Japan's auto sales were up 92% last month compared with a year ago. We'll hear from the U.S. automakers about April sales this morning as well. We've already heard from Chrysler, which did quite well. It's been a good year for all of the U.S. automakers. But what has that success meant for auto workers? Marketplace's Gregory Warner has that story.
Whatever benefits you have at work, chances are they were pioneered by the auto industry in the decades after World War II.
Absolutely. The social contract was really written between the auto industry and the UAW.
Ross Eisenbray at the Economic Policy Institute says now familiar benefits like pensions, health insurance, paid vacations, health care for retirees, all these were won first by auto unions, then demanded by workers around the country. Now, post-recession and post-bailouts, that auto worker safety net is in shreds. Gary Chason is a professor of industrial relations at Clark University.
There is no safety net for auto workers anymore. There's very little to fall back on, and they are very vulnerable to the hard times coming.
Retiree health care benefits are out, so are generous pension plans. And he says wages are half of what they once were, down to around $17 an hour. The one bright spot, you can buy a decent house in Detroit for $40,000. I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
And while we're in Detroit, Ford has an idea to make its car seats a little more comfortable, filling them with cash. Seriously, Ford is thinking about adding old, shredded, out-of-circulation U.S. currency to its list of materials that can be used in seat cushions. So when they say you get $500 cash back with the purchase of a new Ford Focus, they might actually mean that.
Just in a lot of little pieces. And finally, the debt that came back from the debt. A Massachusetts woman got a bill from the state of New Jersey for $73. The Newburyport Daily News says New Jersey thinks it overpaid Alice Mainville on an unemployment check 35 years ago, back when she was a teenager. Mainville of Amesbury, Massachusetts, is not inclined to pay, at least till she sees more documentation. Apparently, the law in Mainville's home state keeps these things on the books forever. Or put another way, in Jersey, we don't forget no debts.
In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.